where to start? Well, I think what became apparent is this double movement between the movements of migration and what you named as sort of migration as an angle, or what you said was with and not about migration, that in this sort of double, that what we discuss in terms of the politics on migration or the politics with migration, that's two aspects, but it's actually going beyond. It's trying to sort of discuss both the movements of migration, but migration as, or maybe I can start by saying the question of vocabulary. The way in which we talk about migration now, at least in the context of Germany and of Europe, is that we keep sort of slipping between refugees and migrants. That was not the case about 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. While not much has, the question is, has that much changed? Other terminologies appears, new ones appear, become commonplace, for instance, the logistical or the infrastructural, the hotspot, the corridor, etc. Ways in which we talk about migration shift. And we need to grapple with that certain things appear and then disappear according to sort of, let's say, that's why we start asking the question, how do we talk about migration, right? Mm-hmm. What does that entail, the way it appears on the scene as something to be talked about? But in reverse, using migration as the angle or the perspective with which we discuss general transformations, not general transformations, but transformations, as you, for example, said, of labor, of citizenship, of the nation state. And then if you talk about migration, how do we grapple between this supposed dissolution of the nation state, the supranational forms of governing, and the nationalisms. But yeah, vocabulary is one aspect and knowledge is the other, where I would like, maybe we can start with the aspect of knowledge, because the mapping has come up in many ways across those few, days, in the last days, not just with the work by Bushra Khalili, but just to recall that every now and then in that summer of migration, every now and then media published maps that all of a sudden were discovered. Maps of migrants who actually sort of, you know, where it was noted how you get from it, you know, what sort of the trajectory is, how to get where you want to go. And they were published as sort of treasure, like findings, as treasure maps, as arcane knowledge, as something completely surprising. And of course, by the time they were published, they were outdated. They were no longer in use. There were two things. One was that everyone seemed to be puzzled that there's networks, that there's knowledge. But this form of sort of the arcane, the way it was addressed, I thought was interesting because there's also a specific desire to that. And the desire of this kind of knowledge that, of course, is also haunts us in terms of being scholars for the most part, or artists, scholars, activists, where that knowledge is part of sort of what we work with. And I was wondering, because with the undercommons, the question of the knowledge is located somewhere else. Not only does migration challenge the disciplines, but with the undercommons, it's clear that we talk about a knowledge that refuses to be known outside of those networks, right? Every now and then we know, like the example that Bernd gave yesterday about that family, Afghani family, I think, that split up to be able to address, what was the word? Vulnerability. To appear as vulnerable and therefore guarantee their entry or their passage. That is not an unusual example. You'd have the for instance, Eurodac, the fact that the knowledge about being fingerprinted. So then in certain communities, there circulates knowledge of how to refuse to be fingerprinted, or what to sort of, that you know where certain, how to escape certain sort of that grasp of Eurodac, which, you know, if it works, that's another question. But I would like to start with that twofold problem, sort of the knowledge in migration and the knowledge about migration with and about. You had that in that double movement, talking about migration, using migration as an angle. Maybe one of you would like to. It's sort of more an extension than a proper question. Who would like to take over from that? It kind of, it haunted me, that knowledge question. You know, when you talk about undercommons or the moral economy of subsistence strategies, once we start talking about it, it becomes a question. It's not just the opposition to saying we need inclusion in citizenship or to understand it as citizenship. It appears on the scene again as that which we talk about, and how then not to romanticize it, or how do we gain knowledge from it that is not equal with that knowledge that circulates in those in those moments of fugitivity?
I mean, I would possibly refer to what Ramses said about the physicality, or I mean, and I think it's not occasionally that that Morten and Harney speak about the hapticality. About or the hold, like in the ship, like the bodies in the hold, and I'm not so sure if this makes really sense then to talk about different kinds of knowledges again, or not to. I mean, and you have let's say this kind of mapping, these mapping fantasies, and you find them in the control rooms of the border control. I mean, these real time mappings, Frontex having a real time scenario and even having a prognostic. I mean, like these cybernetic fantasies of having. Or doing prognostics of the movements and then pointing to logistics. I mean, you have the whole fantasy of tracking migrants on the move. And I would rather think about is if this kind of securitization of migration is really a kind of a secondary problem, or is it not part very much of a kind of economy also? I mean, if you look at the European border regimes, you can, or like even the EU programs, you can see that this is a kind of conjunctur. It's a kind of a program to invest in European economy to make it competitive with the US, for example. So if you have the entry exit program, we need one as well, and so on. And it's, I mean, it's really a question of economical growth and competition. I think it's much more important than just, so to say, I think the security paradigm is not yet really understood. And this has maybe to do with, on the one side, kind of knowledge, and on the other side, maybe it's counter-surveillance, counter-knowledge. I think we are not sure yet how to approach this kind of conflict or antagonism that we see appearing.
I mean, Ramzi, you also started. You started with the body, and then you went to economy. But I thought it was since you started out with comparing the two branches, different branches of the same tree, today's migration and slave trade. I still was reminded how of Avery, how she tried to sort of make that move from the fugitivity that is the property that steals itself. And the reason why I was reminded of that was the logistical aspect, because one of the, we try to separate the various, so we have the humanitarian, this the security, the national, and the logistical, you listed, as forms of narratives in which migration is addressed or being told or formulated. And one of the ways that is presented as sort of a liberal approach, as pro-migration, is that of the economy, right? You'd always have some representative of a large sort of body of global enterprises who says we need migration, right? Migration is productive for society. We need migrant labor. And it's being addressed in the form of, where again, that the question of labor maybe can, it's being addressed in a sense of that which is just-in-time production. Migrant as just the sort of, maybe not yet property, that's the difference, but as a form of economic investment, right? And it's interesting how that is separated from, let's say, the nation's interest in its genealogy, right? Mm-hmm. You have that discussion, but if you have, on the other hand, you have discussions of, it's in German context, for instance, the aging society, you don't, that kind of economic aspect is not, but that's how it's also being complicated, how the nationalism and how the nation has this interest in its genealogy and in controlling reproduction. So they need migrant labor, but they don't want migrant reproduction in the sense of that's why there is also, I think that's what's also at stake in that, in the being able to mourn the photos of dead children or dead babies in the migration across the Mediterranean, but not, right? That's something that is somehow acceptable. That mourning, but it's meant to be not arriving. That sort of that child is not to become part of the nation, the national body. But I think the economic aspect is it's so nasty how that becomes part of a humanitarian or a supposedly liberal kind of approach to migration. Liberal in the sense of liberalization of migratory movements. And I could be wrong, but maybe that's part and parcel of how that language of the economic factor hijacks the basic notion of equality. You know, Kim, when you said it's something that concerns us all, it is one of the problems of talking about migration is that you somehow continue to be stuck in the frame of separating, you know, addressing a certain body of people as migrants and the rest as usually as the we, whatever we that is, and how that sort of keeps informing a logic of, let's say, of an economic logic. So I'm not sure if the separations we make, the humanitarian, the securitarian, the logistical, are they not, that they're all intertwined. I wouldn't know how to answer where the national then comes in there, but that's...
Mm-hmm. Can I say something? Yeah, please. I just wonder if I'm the only migrant guy on stage. And I'm all the time I'm thinking what applies, what... Okay, hi. Zoran.
Nice to meet you.
Whatever, I want, because each time the word comes, a lot of concepts are flowing with it. On one hand, you have this, you know, mass of people, the state of emergency, sort of exceptional state, nobody knows what to do, you see mass of people, and then in my case, you know, guest workers, history, blah, 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 and the language, you know, second generation. But then how many generations do we count then later on? Like the 10th generation migrants and so on, how long does it go? It's like with postmodernism, it's forever now because it's post and then that's after. So, I'm thinking about this. So it includes this mass migration and then the orderly forms of migration. And then also aspects of how the unruly mass or the influx creates kind of forms of unruly laws, like in the US, which don't make sense. For you, the question is not what comes after nations, it's more like what comes after the tweet or after the next executive order, you know. It's more immediate, a more immediate policy. You don't have even time to think about big concepts at the moment, I think. So this all comes into my mind, and to me, it's more or less very daily kind of confrontation. I'm not really a migration scholar, but I'm dealing, you know, I'm living in Kreuzberg, and I'm dealing with the situation there. We have to deal with gentrification, and also it's asylum seekers who hang around, basically. And I once went to this... center, or how do you call this Aufnahme?
Reception
center. And I just noticed that just one person there, hundreds of people, and so, and the help they needed was just simply to talk to these people, which I did. Then I had to go home. I had three kids, so I have to do other things. So it's mm-hmm. to me, it's a very practical thing, and so I try to get from this conference, I try to get something for me, what I can do, because you talked about the physical investment. I'm glad to invest physically. And what I do is this activism via literature, via our literature group. But it turned out, you know, we read migration stories.
And Daughters and Sons of Gastarbeiter, it's called.
Yes, yeah. So we tour around Germany, but it turns out it's not really, it's more a kind of a therapy session for German identity issues. So. So they come to, you don't think Germany is so bad. That's interesting, I thought, and so on. But that's perhaps that's kind of the subjectivity that that migration does to you, because it's somehow a little bit different if you have the stories, and then you develop an activity as an individual, and then, you know, things happen or don't happen. But I think the other phenomenon, the mass, is a total different. It's about indifference and the state of emergency. It's a total different subject, in my view. That you're not yet dealing with individuals, but of course you do all the time. You saw the Bernd's film yesterday, but I think it's a total different topic. But it all is subsumed. You know, this personal stuff and the state of emergency stuff is subsumed under the notion of migration. So, how do you guys deal with the difference?
Oh, us.
You're the migration scholars, which I'm not. I'm just the kind of.
You want to say something? You just look like it, Bernd.
I was those thinking about something slightly different, concerning the logistics and the because. Now, we had this, when we had this study in the hotspot in Chios last year, we had, you could see this desire to track and to understand migrants. And one of the first things that happens is the nationality identification. And so they were very proud to tell us, Frontex, that they have developed a catalog of 120 questions and that they are online and with Wikipedia and Google Maps, so they can force people to show them, show me the street of the village in Syria where you're from, and, you know, what's the name of the mayor. But the interesting thing was also, because we said 120 questions, are you asking all of these questions? It's going to take a long time. And they said, no. We are very clever about this, because they're waiting outside. So if we ask a question to one person, and after he's finished and goes out, he will tell the others. So we need to rotate our questions all the time. And I was thinking, from a logistical point of view, this is really crazy, because what is logistics is, I mean, what is the great invention of logistics? It's the container. It's to standardize everything. Like, it doesn't matter what's inside the container. You can move the container, you know that 10 containers fit into that that width of something, and all this. And so I was wondering if the system is not, like, this perverse form of knowledge production, of the kind of the mirroring of the multiplicity of categories and the invention of new categories and the invention of tools to apply these categories, in the end they might just be, they cause a lot of friction. And so I was wondering if, I mean, you hinted at it, you said just in time, you cannot have just in time if everything needs to go through a bureaucratic process. You cannot have to the point if you want to predetermine all this. But I think you can see it already in the knowledge production of the other side, that they have a huge problem dealing with this. And I think this is why we also, I mean, this is why I find it interesting to have our own knowledge production about the knowledge production of the regime side on migration. And that's why also sometimes I'm not really afraid that we are revealing too much when we are exactly talking about the residual items of information that come from the undercommons, because, I mean, once we talk about them, yeah, I think we are the last ones who know them and the very last ones to talk about them.
That's what I wanted to hint at anyways, that there's a timeline again in that whenever that gets, it's not only when media reveals these treasure maps or whatever, you know, the way they treat them, it's also, of course, our relation to that there's always, it's always too late, or it's not in time. And maybe it's true, it just reflects, it mirrors how the attempts to control migration is always too late. But Zoran, your question was, I mean, what you addressed was, again, was what now in the German context, German-speaking context, is addressed with the terminology of post-migration, right? It's the sort of the idea, so when does the arrival actually happen? You know, in which generation do you lose the affix of migrant? And some within the context of migration studies are trying to use it like post-colonial, that is both the after and the continuation of something, to use it more as a heuristic or as a sort of a concept than a description of reality. But what you hinted to is, again, why it made sense, for me at least, that we started with this talking migration, because in very different contexts it means different things. And migration in the German context is also framed by a specific history and a way that that history in the past 10 years finally got entry, in at least partial entry, into the sort of the official historiography, and how that then is, as Sandro said, you know, the forms of migration 100 years ago are not the ones that are there today. Or that, for instance, I think you made that argument yesterday, Kim, but to point to the fact that, of course, from the migration, there's not just migration to Europe, there's also migration from Europe, or there's migration happening elsewhere. The question is, do we talk about mobility as such again, or do we talk about migration when it appears as something to be talked about? So migration addressed as crisis is also not, then migrants appear as part of migration. But once that moment of oh, something is suddenly there disappears, people disappear from being, or people just seep into the everyday and stop being migrants. Maybe within the racial and racist sort of construct, they keep being addressed as migrants, no matter, by the way, what their passport. I don't have to tell you that. Yeah. But I think that that for me was important. It's not important to figure out exactly what right now here for all of us migration is, but to keep that in on the move, right?
And I might just add to that. I mean, it's interesting from a Canadian perspective. I think the concept of citizenship has much less baggage in a certain sense. It's much less of an unpacked concept, I think, than it's understood in the German context. So I think it's not surprising that a lot of people that have used citizenship in a critical way have a Canadian connection, I would say, if I can locate it, like look at that. And I think, you know, for us, one of the important things is to not fetishize or romanticize movement in itself, right? Because we're constantly holding... right now, one of the most or the most political question for us right now, right, is to hold political struggles around migration, refugee issues, very much in social justice in alliance with indigenous struggles, right? And so freedom to movement has to be really held in that context of freedom to stay, freedom to claim, freedom to move within, you know, your notion of territory, which is not territorially bound necessarily, if I think about, for example, the Cree community, which I know a little bit about. So I think that's really important for us. So it's almost the opposite in a way. We're not problematizing migration to Canada. You know, we're problematizing the relationship of social justice to people who have been there for a long time and who, you know, celebrating 150 years of Canada right now, right, is a celebration. It's not a celebration for Indigenous peoples, right? It's an act of colonialism. So
maybe that's also good. Moment to open to the audience. I know there's microphones which help in with the communication and the translation. So if you want to join in, and those who sit in this side of the, you kind of have to probably stand up or yell, because you're not really visible as opposed to that section. Is there someone somewhere? Yeah? Okay.
Hello.
Wow. Much
better. So someone here, yeah? No? You were that was a misunderstanding. You were waving that's where the microphone is. I thought you were pointing to some. Sorry. No one feels compelled, right? We're kind of hailed on this side. You illuminated the spotlights on you? No. Okay. I was wondering, though, because, I mean, you also, I guess you came with expectations and your own set sort of questions of how to discuss migration. And maybe I take something very, there's two things I take from myself as a big criticism of, as one of the curators of this entire event, that two things I think I, because for me, of course, this is a continuum in an on, we are, you know, we, it, it, I forget that what my continuity in addressing things is not everybody else's continuity. And one of the things is that you addressed in your presentation, Brigitta, on the standard of civilization. That is the way the nation is, okay, here's a question, the way the nation is imbued with race, and how we need to talk about migration, we also need to talk about racism. And the other thing is, in the way that Sandro was saying, that you used the formulation, the dramatic feminization of migration, and the feminization paradigm around migration has been critically discussed. And the question is what it means. Does it mean that now there are so many more women migrating, or does it mean that there's a form of configuration of migrants into what sort of a position in the labor market that has usually sort of is associated with a gendered labor market? And that, in addition to other moments where I realized we forgot, we didn't address the question of genealogy of the nation in terms of exactly the question of gender. But that's a criticism. Yeah, to me, and I think there was a question, so please.
Yes, I have a question about Sandro's point. You mentioned practical and theoretical migration management, and then two examples of just-in-time and to the point. The just-in-time part, you gave Fedora as an example, and I wanted to know if there is an example for the to the point. If you could expand a little bit on both of them, just to help me to understand the fantasy haunting the migration management. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for the question. Actually, Fedora works both for time and for space, because you want a pizza right now in this particular point where you are based, that can be your place. But Fedora doesn't imply the recruitment of migrant labor. I was using it as an instance of a specific logistical rationality. There are similar platforms that work for domestic labor, for instance. You can use such platforms in order to recruit a domestic worker for 6 hours, again, in a specific place that can be the place where you live. But I also think that there is a need to go beyond these important examples and to look also at very traditional kind of economic sectors. I remember some years ago I was working on ship construction in Eastern Europe, and particularly in Romania, and the way in which workers were recruited was through agencies that were based outside of the country, in that particular case in Bangladesh, and were able to provide experienced workers for the time they were needed and in the specific shipyard where they were needed. So 6 months on the coast in a specific shipyard. There are many other examples. I mean, they could be easily multiplied. I think this is a kind of rationality that spurs many attempts to manage the mobility of labor nowadays. I must add that it remains a fantasy, as Bernd was hinting at. I mean, it remains a fantasy, but as we know, I mean, from psychoanalysis, fantasies have concrete effects.
As an addendum, 2 weeks ago we did here, also at this very location, a workshop, The Apparatus of Racism, where legal anthropologist from Paris, Chaura Makarimi, was talking about those media trials in France that basically create a sort of is a form of criminalization of a specific body of people living in France that is of young male citizens with a migratory background, racialized bodies. And one of the correlations she made was to the agencies for temporary labor. Because the way that works, it's a form of criminalization, it creates criminal records, and those temporary labor agencies don't ask for those records. So that's then the labor market in which they can enter with their criminal records that was created by a racialized sort of justice system that addresses them, again, in a different form, also as migrants, whether they have or do not have French citizenship. Most of them have, but they come often from the banlieue, etc., which I thought was interesting because that makes a point for that kind of sort of the just in time in a very specific configuration of the law. But that just as a footnote. There was another question right here. Do you already have the microphone here? Oh, first here. Okay.
Okay, thank you. I also have a question to Sandro Mesadra, please. And I would like you to develop a little bit more on the last point of your presentation, because I miss your talk yesterday too, on the relationship of tension between migration and democracy you mentioned, maybe regarding the possibilities of making sense of violence, of legal, illegal violence. Because I know that you are able to put together a lot of ideas, maybe I'll mention another aspect which may be correlated to what I just said. I just don't find the argumentation to do it in a perfect question, but it's about concerning the veiling and unveiling of Muslim women from the public space. So perhaps you want to say something in relation to that, the control of visibility, the body. Now the new discourse is saying, I have read, for example, in Nigeria that more and more laws are getting passed so that no woman in Nigeria can go out with a burqa because they are afraid of bombs. And I think that's a pretty much westernized discourse which has been exported and which also has this colonial legacy, right, which Fanon already was mentioning in his book. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Two quite different topics. I will try to keep my answers short, just for want of time, because the two topics are very interesting to me. At the end of my talk, I was trying to imagine or to make a small contribution to the collective imagination of a political framework that allows us to make sense of contemporary struggles of migration without isolating them. And this is an important point for me. It has also to do with the discussion of the autonomy of migration approach that I was starting yesterday. I think one of the dangers of the autonomy of migration approach that I have contributed to develop across the last years is that it may lead to isolate migrants and refugees' struggles from wider societal processes and trends. I mean, just the example of the summer of migration is clear from this point of view. I mean, you can and you must say migrants and refugees were able to challenge the border regime in Europe, were able to open up new spaces of freedom and equality, were able to make the travel to Europe safer, as Bernd very well explained yesterday. But then you also have to think of the articulation between these practices, between these expressions of the autonomy of migration, with, let's say, wider coalitions of movements struggling for social justice, as Kim was saying, speaking of Canada. So this moment of articulation is particularly important to me. From this point of view, I have been struck by Avery Gordon's presentation yesterday, because she mentioned the book that I particularly like, that I find particularly inspiring today, although it has not to do with the contemporary age. It's a book published by the great African-American scholar and activist W.E.B. Du Bois in 1935, bearing the title Black Reconstruction. And this is a book that really challenges at the time the historical common sense in the US regarding civil war and regarding reconstruction, which means the age that comes after the end of the civil war. It challenges this common sense because for the first time, Du Bois contends that slaves were protagonists of their own liberation. And carefully maps the manifold forms of agency of the slaves in the plantations, of runaway slaves that asked to become part of the army of the Union. And he says, if you take together all these forms of action, including sabotage on the plantation, you have to talk of a general strike of the slaves that compelled the Union to assume the goal of the abolition of slavery. So this is a very important kind of historical example where you have a racialized and enslaved population that through its struggles opens up a new political space. And Du Bois adds something more. He says, within this new political space that was opened up by slaves, by the general strike of slaves, a new political project and practice developed. And he calls this political project and practice abolition democracy. So maybe you can see the parallel with what I was saying before regarding the summer of migration, although the geography and history are different. A moment of struggle of a very specific subject, racialized, enslaved, and then the articulation with this project of abolition democracy. It's from this point of view that I find that this example inspiring. Maybe there is no time for the veil.
There's one here, and then a question here, and then here, and then, okay.
Now in Germany,
maybe we collect a few questions, and yeah.
Sure.
Go ahead.
So in Germany, both state officials and civil society actors have, for the first time it seems, have stated that to understand and undo migration, you have to understand the reasons for people to migrate, or more precisely for refugees to seek refuge in Europe. Now, that brings me to actually the Middle East, and Cemil Aydin on his very first day in his presentation, he spoke about the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the Balfour Declaration, all these declarations of colonialism that led to particular nation states while at the same time refusing nation states for other people. And if you ask Syrians, many would have preferred to stay. And the same, they would have preferred to stay in Syria, and Berlin actually being the biggest refugee camps for Palestinians outside of the Middle East, they too would have preferred to stay, and they too would have preferred to be asked why they had to come here and why they cannot go back. And so that brings me to the question about, you know, the research and activism of migrant scholars to particularly ask about reasons for having to come here, the reasons to connect Europe and Middle East, the reasons for having to leave in the first place.
Hi, Sandra mentioned, was talking about unruly thinking on migration and the necessity of opposition, of to oppose the borders of disciplinary thinking inside and outside academy. And I'm from Brazil, and I see that there's still a big resistance in terms of a social role that a thinker of migration plays in society. So one should be either a journalist or an activist or a scholar, or, you know, you can't really. So this is already a border for thinking on migration and before the disciplinary thinking, even outside academy. So just as a social role you play in society. So I don't know, it's like an open question for who wants to answer. How do you see that here? I mean, I've living almost 2 years in Berlin, then I felt more open, that here is more open, like this, the more porous views is more, how can I say? Yeah, it's not so rigid, the barriers in this social role are not so rigid. So how do you see that in your work, people who do more or activism work or together with scholar work, and how do you see that if it's changing, if it has changed during your career or your, you know, career as thinkers?
There.
Yes, I'm reminded of the French politician who said, "We asked for workers and human beings came." And that is something that I think more emphasis on human beings is necessary in this debate. I'm coming as a stranger to the subject academically. It's not my subject at all. But I did have some. I'm a migrant myself from the United States to France, so that's luxury migration, let's say. But I have had the experience of becoming integrated into another community. And human beings are speaking animals. I mean, we talk. And if you can't talk, and if you can't express yourself clearly, then you're not going to be included. It's very difficult to arrive somewhere and not be able to be part of the situation, even the simplest situation. So I would say, if I haven't heard people talk about budgets and how to welcome migrants, but if I have a budget, I certainly, after the basics, food and shelter are taken care of, I would say language schools should be compulsory. And female migrants should be obliged to go. And if you don't go, then you get a terrible threat of being deported or something like that. You have to learn the language and you have to learn how to be included, whether you are male or female. And the children should go, under the age of 10, the children should go to school with the local kids because they will pick up the language very quickly and very naturally. And I may have missed it, but I didn't hear any discussion of how you can help people to become the neighbors that they would like to be. And if they leave, most people are going to stay, but if they leave, they will become ambassadors for your country when they go back to their original country. So in any case, you're making a good investment. You're making a good investment in human beings who would like to become workers and community members, and you're making a good investment for the future. So that's how I would spend my budget. I wonder if you have comments. I'm supposed to leave. I'm sorry. I have another engagement. Well, but
there's one more last question right behind. Sorry? Okay, yeah. Ramzi, you wanted to immediately respond to begin at the very end.
Yeah, let me, just quickly, I think to the first question that was raised, I think it's important to understand the various push factors, be they political or economic or otherwise, that drive migration. And without that understanding, without that analysis, and importantly, without an equally deep and serious examination of, you know, your own society's role in the creation of those push factors, be it a historical role or a contemporary role. If you're sitting in the United States or you're sitting in the European Union, you need to ask yourself, what is your own society's, what is your own government's responsibility for the creation and sustaining of those push factors that are bringing, you know, migrants to your shores or across your borders? The question you asked, I thought, was also sort of a central question. I mean, for my part, I feel like you have to connect your scholarship to your activism, to your practice, right? Because otherwise what you end up with is an academic world where people are speaking in an insular language that is completely inaccessible to the people that, you know, whose condition you're actually trying to address, and you're sort of cut off from various audiences that you want to try to reach. So I think if there isn't that kind of material connection between your scholarly endeavors and your actual practical active pursuits, then you're inevitably going to end up in this insular world where, you know, you're more or less ineffectual and, you get my point. The last thing I'll say, I completely agree with you about the importance, Susan, of language and of stressing the human aspect, and that goes back to a point you were making earlier, because I think if you don't do that, then you end up inevitably subordinating people's, very human rights and entitlements and expectations to an economic or capitalist imperative of, you know, we're asking for workers, and oh my God, now we're stuck with these human beings with sort of the fullness of their existence and their needs. And I think, you know, language is basic, but I think the problem really is a problem of allocating the necessary amount of funding to give people the support to acquire the language that they need. I really don't believe that making it compulsory is necessary. I think that's overkill. I think that's it could even be experienced as oppressive and needlessly coercive. I think most people who end up migrating by necessity or even sort of desire would be very happy to partake of language support programs and acquire the cultural and linguistic wherewithal to be able to acclimate to the society they're in. I think making it compulsory, because in some countries there have been proposals to make it compulsory, and in other countries those proposals have actually been implemented, I think that adds a layer of coercion and subordination that doesn't fit well with the intent that might drive allocating the budget to that end.
Also later had experience teaching migrants. There was a great difference between those who didn't know how to read and write their own language and those who did, because the ones who did know about reading and writing in a language went much faster. So okay, don't make it compulsory. But you can also have volunteer groups. In any small town, you will find seniors who would love to teach language to new people. You don't have to pay a fortune to organize that. And if people understand that this is happening and that they can help, I think you immediately get a participation.
Wonder how
I would Canada. I would like to add there that instead of talking about budgets, I would talk about the politics of listening. I would also talk about the history of language and schooling as disciplinary institutions, in particular in Germany. And right now, the institutionalization of the so-called welcoming classes within schools for sort of kids who there's not no concept and no willingness to have let them actually transfer into regular schools. And before we talk about policing for non-participation, we need to remember, at least in this context, and I'm sure it's elsewhere the same, of withholding access to language learning and withholding of access of equal schooling. And this accounts to the history sort of my fellow scholars in critical migration studies who all in the German context didn't get the so-called recommendation to the college degree to get a high school diploma because they were meant as migrants to only become workers. So I'm just saying that we have to, like, language and schools are institutions which have been applied by the nation state as disciplining regulations and have a history of policing from the other side, and that we need to take into account. And in terms of, you know, learning languages, also, as I said, there's a form of listening into speech. That's a formulation by a scholar, I forgot her name, where it's not about the full translation, but about the willingness to engage in a situation of maybe not sharing the same language. And of becoming, and this very morning where we had this, even though it was in the frame of the law, but we had English, German, and French happening at the same time as a form of deliberation around the right to stay and the copyright. The fact that those colonial languages, but there were those languages present at the same time, is just as a small hint to the fact that there resides a different opportunity in outside of disciplining. But sorry, there was a last, yeah, please.
Just a little anecdote, shows a little the paradox here a little bit. A friend of mine, parents, migrants from Turkey, she was born in Berlin. Then knew to speak German fluently. Then they moved back away, and then a couple of years they came back to Berlin school and so on. It was compulsory for her to join the German language class, but paradoxically, only Turkish children hang out there, so she mostly spoke German, Turkish, and forgot to actually German. Unlearned German in the German class because she would hang out only with Turkish children, so she mostly spoke Turkish. You see that you need to look at the case. You said yourself it's individuals, humans. Look at the case. Compulsory is not a good idea.
There was... yeah.
No, it's good to bring it up. So you can.
Does it work?
Please.
Now, this one. Thank you very much.
I thought you needed two microphones.
Hi, so thank you very much. I'm very grateful that we are discussing these topics in this academic context. But so I talked about what could be a bit more different, and my idea was maybe we could nuance the concept of migration, because so I tell my story. I heard in the introduction migration. Migrants are questioning the legitimacy of the nation state in Germany. So I'm a migrant myself, but I really don't feel well to reclaim it for myself because I can talk for any other migrants. So I felt honored by this sentence. I am questioning the whole nation state. Absurd feeling of being honored by questioning the whole nation state pointed to the point which I want to tell you, that I feel migrants are not the next nation. I mean, it's not a general term, it's so different. And I understand that you also discussed these topics, but maybe that's what could be a second step or first, we thematize, we discuss this topic in this academic field, and maybe then we could thematize these questions of gender and so on, and also inner conflicts among migrants, which are also, you can experience all the day. So, I think that's what I wanted to say. So, thank you.
We're reaching the very end. So your last chance, one more question or comment? I would like to pick, okay, please.
Migrant is a bit of a difficult concept. We all actually have a Google map, see, on a laptops. And what we do not actually have on it, you see, is actually borders. We don't know, you see, there is a river, you see, if we cross that, you see, we'll get drowned. I mean, to come back to that, I mean, migrant actually refers to a thing that is actually very unstable, that is a border. I mean, anybody who actually had this sort of historical map and traced, I mean, how borders, you see, are migrating, will actually see that they actually jump around, you see, I mean, on continents, like people doing a tarantella dance. So that's the problem, you see, is that actually, I mean, if we actually have either a Google map situation, you see, where we indeed see do not have any borders at all, or at least securing, you see, that borders, you see, are stable. And the one thing, of course, we talked about language, and of course we have got, you see, I mean, a number of lingua franca that we actually developed. At the moment it is actually English, and we're communicating in English, which unfortunately actually has the effect, you see, that the people, I mean, who are most insular in their language, you see, are people from an Anglo background, because they usually actually only know one language. Whereas if you go to a place like Johannesburg, you actually have people, I mean, who actually use four languages. They actually go into some kind, you see, I mean, of communication, and they start, let's say, see, in Sotho, and then they change over to Afrikaans and English, and then go to Zulu. So as a matter of fact, we actually have, specifically in Africa, many people who actually know lots of different languages. I mean, whereas, you see, we in nation states usually tend to be rather sort of monolingual. I mean, even if we actually learn, you see, other languages at school, it is actually rather monolingual. So, and we, one of the reasons for it, you see, is that we actually demand, you see, that people, I mean, are 100%, you see, in that specific language, which actually makes sense. But of course, it's, I mean, in countries where we actually have, you see, real multilingual existences, and Africa, I mean, is actually really quite good in that. We actually have to lower the standards. We must allow, you see, I mean, the development of Patois and Creole languages. And we should actually, I mean, also reflect that. So the problem, see, is what to do about borders. Jack Kerouac, I mean, wrote a book called On the Road, and he is not a migrant, because what he did, you see, in On the Road, you see, was actually traveling, you see, in one country, or maybe crossing the border to Mexico, which didn't really count at that time. And of course it does right now. So we actually have a number, you see, I mean, of logical problems.
I think we come to an end, and I think taking that question of the what do we talk about in which language, I would like to quote to close this session from a short sort of manifesto by a friend of mine, Daniel Hendrickson, who works as a translator, who collects languages like other people collect, I know. Not only sunglasses, maybe. Yeah. and he wrote that short text, The Rhizome of Babel, for a book, the cookbook on political imagination, which is published on the occasion of Yael Bartana's representation of Poland as an Israeli artist in the Venice Biennial. And he writes, each of us will speak whichever language he or she chooses as the situation arises. The choice of language will be left to the speakers, to be negotiated according to ability, context, or simply personal whim. We will be free to switch from one to the other as we see fit. We will not be required to speak only one, and we will not even be required to announce which one it is that we are speaking. It will not require you to understand me, nor will I blame myself if I don't understand you. The point of language will no longer be about communication, but also about pleasure and politics. Thank you.